Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Jim, the mail came.
Great. What's in there today?
Let's see. A bill for website hosting, publishers clearing out sweepstakes, appointment reminder from the proctologist, a summons, our Jelly of the Month Club, and
Rolling Stone Magazine. All right, so Patrick.
Jim.
Remember Rolling Stone magazine?
Yeah, of course.
Did you used to read that?
I did, yeah. I used to subscribe to it in the 1980s.
It was actually how I learned to read. My parents would sit me down at night. We'd read about, Neil Young or something.
Yes, exactly. One word at a time, Jim.
Yeah. If only that were true. So we wanted to talk a little bit on Rockin' the Suburbs here about Rolling Stone, because I think it's an important publication in sort of like our suburban musical history.
Without
what
a doubt.
You say?
Yeah.
As I mentioned, you're listening to Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I am Patrick Foster.
And the reason why we're going to talk about Rolling Stone magazine is because there was just news a couple of days ago as we record this that the magazine is for sale.
Yeah, Jan Wenner has put the magazine up for sale.
Jan Wenner, who of course founded the magazine.
Jan Wenner.
Now getting out of that business.
Yeah, right. Getting out of the magazine.
About 50 years later, I think.
1967, founded in San Francisco with Jan Wenner and Ralph Gleason, who is a music journalist on the West Coast, maybe at the San Francisco Chronicle or something like that. He was a pretty established jazz critic. $7,500 loan, and they started this magazine as a biweekly. And initially, on its founding, Jim, it was very much identified with the counterculture, the hippie counterculture, and really made its mark that way. And at the time, there wasn't much serious, quote-unquote, rock criticism.
That's right.
Crawdaddy Magazine really probably was the only one, that was doing anything serious, taking pop music seriously.
Right. So back at that time in 67 and in San Francisco, they were really kind of in the heart of music in America at that time. I think John Lennon was their first cover subject.
Mm-hmm.
It was on newsprint, so it felt like a sort of... it felt like sort of an alternative publication in a way, like something that somebody's just rolling off a press somewhere getting it in your hands.
Yeah, so it had that newsy feel to it. Yeah.
That's right. And it was. It was an attempt to sort of take this culture seriously in some way. And like I said, I think it did feel sort of counterculture at that time. We were too young
to certainly feel that impact. And the magazine gave, a national voice to a lot of important writers. I mean, Cameron Crowe, Lester Bangs, Patti Smith wrote for the magazine. Dave Marsh was its editor, records editor for a long time. And of course, Hunter S. Thompson.
Right.
Published the Fear and Loathing series. Both in Las Vegas and covering the McGovern campaign in the 70s.
And when I got into the magazine in the 80s.
Yeah, that's when I started reading it too.
Probably right around 1980 or so. And I was an avid reader, subscriber of Rolling Stone throughout that decade.
Mm-hmm, me too.
I think I dropped off somewhere maybe in the mid 90s-ish. But, and for me being an aspiring writer myself, like I knew the names of the music writers, so Anthony DeCurtis, right, and Dave Marsh and J.D. Considine and all these guys who wrote for the magazine, like I knew who they were. They were to me kind of like rock stars in a way.
Yeah.
And actually, once I met Anthony DeCurtis, totally by chance, at a restaurant, in Bloomington, Indiana. He was sitting at the next table. He was there to like give a speech something.
And you recognized him.
And I recognized
him. That's fantastic.
Right. And he was sitting by himself, and I just said hello, and we had a little chat.
Isn't that
funny?
That's very cool.
So anyway, so Rolling Stone's for sale. And first thing I want to say is this gives us a chance to get into magazine publishing if we want to do that.
Yes, exactly. We got the opportunity. Right. We might need a little capital, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we'll put the call out to listeners if anybody wants to help fund that exercise, right? But seriously, what is your feeling about the impact of Rolling Stone? I mean, I think it's had a huge impact on music and culture in this country. What are your memories, I guess, of it, first of all, and then what do you think about that impact, good or bad or somewhere in between?
my experience was a lot like yours. I started reading the magazine in the early 80s when I was beginning to broaden my horizons. To me, and I think in the broader impact of Rolling Stone magazine, you know, was the fact that it gave legitimacy to the form, but also set a standard, I think, you know, in writing about rock music that most everybody else who got into that business, whether you're doing a fanzine or, you know, starting a magazine like Spin Magazine, to me was sort of like, let's go back to the original spirit of Rolling Stone, you know, and try to bring that back. But so I think in that sense, its impact, you know, can hardly be overstated. Nowadays, the place of a magazine is, you know, it's debatable whether or not that it can really have the same sort of impact it did. But it was very much of its time, but I think also grew and matured. And for me, the big thing was that college chart. Remember they used to have like the college chart in the near the back of the Rolling Stone that would show like an alternative, like here's what's, you know, college radio. To me, that was the first thing I always looked at when the magazine came. It's like, what's in the top 10, you know, right now? And it would be Husker Du or The Replacements or, you know, some bands like that. So you found out about a lot of really interesting bands because of that, especially when I was in high school and, you know, working in a chain record store, you needed some help to start to look a little bit beyond, you know, the top 40 in the mainstream and or in classic rock.
So first thing, like you mentioned, when you go back to that time, what's important for people to understand was there was not the same access to music that we have today by any means.
No.
So one thing that Rolling Stone really did was, as you mentioned, sort of broaden your horizons because you could read about bands that weren't getting commercial airplay, right? And so, and that was probably one of the, you know, key methods of discovery back then, was actually like reading, not hearing them first, but reading, you know, somebody saying this is a great record and here's why. And then, you know, it might prompt you to go out and buy it or listen to it, whatever. The other thing though that you mentioned is the Spin comparison. Mm-hmm. So as I look back now on Rolling Stone, I mean, I was a very avid reader. I got it from the time I was, you know, a kid buying records on, you know, into well into my 20s, I would say. Maybe next to MTV, probably the sort of the biggest influence on my sort of like young, you know, sense of like what is good music and what isn't. I think that's sort of good and bad. And here's what I want to say about Rolling Stone is, I think overall, looking back on it, had a good sense of what good music was, right? Or is, or what should be, you know, championed.
Mm-hmm.
For example, and I apologize if listeners are into this kind of music, and there's not, that's not all bad, but sure. I don't think they always sort of follow trends. So I think even in like the 70s, I don't remember them like, say, championing a lot of like prog rock bands.
No, uh-uh.
A lot of the big sort of bloated arena rock bands.
No, exactly.
Or, you know, disco, I think they kind of largely ignored. Mm-hmm. Although, in retrospect, I think there's actually some really good disco music. But nevertheless, at the time, what they kind of stuck to what they felt, or what Jan or whomever felt was, you know, sort of the best in terms of like what, you know, rock music. They sort of stuck to this core belief.
Yeah.
What was good. Mm-hmm. And they did embrace, I think, you know, punk to a large extent because of that, because it sort of fit into their definition of what was, you know, good music.
Yep. Hip hop to a certain degree as well.
Hip hop to a certain degree, although I think they fell short there to a certain degree as well. And then I think, you know, the alternative scene of the 80s got a certain amount of attention in Rolling Stone. My only thing, though, looking back on this, though, it makes me wonder if my interest might have been shaped a little bit differently, though, if I hadn't been so, you know, stuck with Rolling Stone. Is I do think it was all filtered through sort of a baby boomer prism.
Yeah.
Right?
To some degree, that's very true.
And I think they continued over time to continue to champion 60s acts above a lot of others.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. And I think maybe in a lot of cases, long past their prime, when maybe a lot of acts weren't doing necessarily great work, but they would still get covers on Rolling Stone. They would still get, you know, glowing reviews. Yeah. They, you know, it was almost like there was a core group of artists that could do no wrong in Rolling Stone's eyes. And even as we look today,
we have some recent issues here. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it is Paul McCartney,
right?
But on this issue that I'm holding up, which is about a year ago, you know, here's Paul McCartney, the Rolling Stone interview on the cover. Honestly, though, I'm not sure. It's not that Paul McCartney doesn't have fans. It doesn't still sell out shows, right. But he's not really part of like the modern musical landscape in any way.
No. I mean, I'm sure, you know, all those questions are mostly about the Beatles, probably, you know, you know, that people want to read about. Yeah.
And it's fine. They're putting out 26 issues a year. I mm-hmm. I get it. But my point being, though, is I think they continued over 50 years to just revert back to that. That felt safe to them, you know. Just keep putting out the same, like, boomer acts championing them. Not to say they didn't have acts like The Clash and R.E.M.
Yeah, exactly.
And others on the cover, but usually at the point at which they became sort of boomer approved.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, when they were already sort of broken that seal.
That's right. Yeah. And when they had kind of shown, I think Rolling Stone to a large extent subscribed to an old school model, which was that, you know, critical acclaim was one thing, but you still had to have some level of commercial success.
That's right. Yeah. And those were, you know, kind of the ideals from when the magazine was founded in the 70s, right? When they had their greatest success and they held on to those. You're right.
So it almost makes me wonder if, you know, you said, like, I think when Spin came around, it was more like of a Generation X sort of mentality,
exactly.
Right? And it was almost like, not to say that there shouldn't be an appreciation for older music. There definitely should. And we both believe that very strongly.
Of course.
Right? But that it wanted to be current. It wanted to focus on, like, what's happening today. What feels vital today.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I almost wonder if I had... That had happened to me maybe earlier on in my life where somebody said, you know, kind of like, you know, certainly, you know, listen to Neil Young, Bob Dylan, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, really focus on, like, what's new and what, you know, what's happening now. If I might have developed, I think, you know, musical appreciation sort of in a little bit different way, or maybe faster, I think, than I did.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I know what you mean.
And more, felt more like I was part of something. Another thing I'll say, like, I'm not sure Rolling Stone ever, like, reported on a emerging music scene until it had already emerged.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
No, that's
like,
a very good point.
I don't think they focused on the Seattle bands until they became popular, or Minneapolis, or whatever. You know, did you ever get the feeling they were part of something that was like of the groundswell?
Right.
You know what
I mean? Exactly. Yeah. Or you know, we're really put somebody on the cover that kind of broke them, you know, nationally. Right. You're exactly right. It was more of a reactive stance
that
they took, right?
That's
a proactive
right.
one.
I don't want to come off that I'm complaining about it.
No, no.
And it's certainly...
But your points are well made.
Certainly... may seem a little bit hypocritical from, like, two old guys sitting in a basement talking about music we loved when we were kids.
That's right.
Which we do a lot of the time. Then just to speak to where things are today. So the magazine is, you know, one of the things that was really impressive about the magazine, and I remember really enjoying every time I would get it, was it was just huge.
Yeah.
It was oversized, you know, dimension-wise, and then just really thick. And you mentioned the chart at the back, but the other thing I really like, beyond just sort of like the big interviews and all of that, was like there were all these like really cool, weird, bizarre like ads in the back.
Yeah, exactly.
Little ads
in the marketplace.
Yeah. Yes. You know, and it, you know, to some extent you did feel like, especially for me, a kid, you know, in the Midwest, you felt like at this point it was obviously being published out of New York.
Yeah.
You felt like it had a different sort of sensibility than the place you were growing up, and it was kind of, you know, exciting.
Yeah,
and
exactly. Things.
You know, we didn't mention a couple of the other magazines that I didn't really get into around that same time were like Cream. Were you a Cream reader?
I was a little bit too young to really catch the you know,
same
that
here.
Wave of like when Lester Bangs
70s.
And Dave Marsh. Yeah. It was kind of an early 70s thing, and I kind of missed that a little bit. I think going back historically, I came to appreciate what they did, but they were in many ways the countercultural voice to Rolling Stone at that time. Yeah.
And Circus was another one.
Circus was more of like a teen magazine from what I remember.
Yeah.
But I used to buy it a lot because it had Kiss on the front a lot. And I was way into Kiss.
But neither one of those seemed very serious. Like it almost treated music. I mean, Lester Bangs, maybe a little bit different, but it didn't have the same kind of like professional tone to it that Rolling Stone did.
It had more of a sophomoric kind of approach.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And so in that sense, I did always appreciate that Rolling Stone, that this was serious art, that this was something that was important.
And, and they continued to, you know, cover politics and you know, some world issues and things like that as well, which was part of their scope originally.
Some of the other magazine that I read in the 80s was called Musician.
Do you remember that
mm-hmm. one?
Yeah.
And that was really good, and they would do some really good work they had some of the funniest record reviews, as I recall. They were like really short little capsules, and they were really like funny and snarky.
Yeah.
So like that.
Right.
Where we are today with, you know, publishing is obviously just a totally different world. And
yeah,
the oversized magazine of Rolling Stone is gone. It's more the traditional, you know, dimensions. It's very, very thin. The page count is very small. And obviously it's a digital world these days. And I think they were kind of slow to react to that.
Yeah, exactly. That was part of it. And America just never had the culture or, you know, sort of the size to support you know, music journalism the way, you know, where there were weekly papers in England, right? In London, there was four or five, you know, Melody Maker, New Music Express, and Sounds, like they all came out once a week, and they were huge, and they were like more, you know, they had a little bit of that tabloid to them, but...
I'm glad you mentioned those too, because I would occasionally, you'd find a bookstore that where you could get a Melody Maker or an NME.
An import, yeah.
And that just felt like way more exciting.
It,
you know?
It really did, yeah. And they were just raving about these bands that you
never heard of, right? It felt like they really had their finger on the pulse of something that was like emerging. Yes. Village Voice too.
Yeah, there you go.
There would always be like a bookstore where you could get the Village Voice. Mm-hmm. I would usually get that at the end of the year because they had that Paz and Jop poll of critics, poll. And it would list, you know, the best records, and that was always felt like it was
relevant.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so then it would be like, well, what have I missed here? Mm-hmm. But every once in a while, you know, you'd read the Village Voice, and you'd feel like, again, like they sort of knew something that others didn't. So where do people read about music these days? I guess it's Pitchfork.
And
Stereo Gum, I think, and AV Club,
and Sound,
Consequence
those kind
Sound.
Of places. Yeah, you're right. On Paste, probably a place like that. Yeah.
Yep. Suburbspod.com.
Suburbspod.com.
All right, so we'll see what happens with Rolling Stone.
Yeah, see who buys it.
See if it changes that at all. And
we could buy that
thing. Influences a whole new generation of kids.
Yeah, we'll buy it and hire Craig Rosen as our managing editor.
Oh, there you
let
go.
Let him get cracking on it.
That sounds like a great plan.
Yeah.
All right, so listen to Rock in the Suburbs.
Every day.
You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Audioboom, other podcast platforms.
Mm-hmm.
You can read some stuff that we write from time to time at suburbspod.com. You can also email us, tell us about your memories of Rolling Stone magazine, rock@suburbspod.com, or call the Suburban Party Line, which is
612-440-1984.
And you can also find us on social medias, because we're big on that. We're ahead of the curve.
We love the social medias.
Not really, but we're right there with the curve, maybe. That would be Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, @SuburbsPod. All right. So we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
It was the 3rd of September. That day I'll always remember. Yes, I will. 'Cause that was the day that my daddy died. I never got a chance to see him. Never heard nothing but bad things about him. Mama, I'm depending on you to tell me the truth. Mama just hung her head and said, son, Papa was a rolling stone. Wherever he laid his hat was his home.
There's actually some really good disco music.